That noise, what's that racket?
That's the press, baby. The press. And there's nothing you can do about it. Nothing.
Now, you want to run the story? You got 5 hours until 8 o'clock. Go get the story.
I know newspapers backward, forward, and sideways. I can write them, edit them, print them, wrap them, and sell them.
Don't need anybody right now.
I can handle big news and little news. And if there's no news, I'll go out and bite a dog.
Yeah, that's what we do. That's what we all do, yes. That's what you do. You go out and bite a dog if you want to make some news. I'm Steve Scheer. Knute Berger. Eli Sanders.
Berger.
Knute Berger. I don't know what has happened to me.
2 weeks in a row.
Knute Berger, Joni Balter, Eli Sanders. That's because you know, it's Joni's fault, because last week she said that she wanted to try the Knute Berger. Knute Berger is the writer at Crosscut. Has the moss back. Joni Balter is a news analyst. Eli Sanders is associate editor at The Stranger. Eli brought in through the snowy streets, he brought in a lovely gift. Rum balls.
Bourbon balls.
Excuse me.
And what I said is that if everybody tried one, it would be a different show.
Yes. Which you promptly did.
And so which it, I promptly did.
Let's get ready to rumble.
Very nice. Very nice. Okay. There's a lot to talk about. And at the end of this hour, we will be, as 11 o'clock rolls around, we'll be hearing from President Obama. So we'll come back to what the president has to be saying later. So we thought we'd start a little closer to home. But I just would like to say one thing about the Duck Dynasty guy, which I'd never heard of, and I didn't really know that you could make a fortune doing duck calls, but that just shows how ignorant I am about hunting.
I was so glad that you said that you didn't know who he was before this as well, because that made at least two of us.
But he said some, characterize it any way you want, venal, unpleasant things about gays, but did anybody hear what he said about America and African Americans and how they were pretty good back in the day when there was slavery and that there was no blues back then?
I did hear him say that. I think it really unfortunate, some of the things he said. I don't know why folks seem like they still need to talk about this, because every single person who goes down this road to try to characterize their position on this seems to get in some sort of trouble.
Well, he gets Bobby Jindal to all of a sudden come out and say he's a free speech. He's advocating free speech. And Fox News and a lot of conservatives have turned this into a free speech issue, even though it's really a television issue, right? This is about TV.
Yeah, TV programming, I'm not sure. They get to decide who's on the air, just like Fox News does. So, but I've never seen the show. I don't know anything about it. I look at him, I see like the militia version of ZZ Top or something.
I have no idea
why these guys are famous. I know nothing about it. I have no desire to know anything about it. You know, they can just stay in the bayou or wherever they come from.
I was actually, until he opened his mouth about race and sexuality, looked like someone I would like to go hunting with if I was to ever go hunting.
Can you do a duck call or not?
No, you buy them.
No.
They're very nice. I thought the LA Times had an article pointing out that in Los Angeles, sodomy is still illegal. In Louisiana, sodomy is still illegal. Bobby Jindal was defending free speech and people's right to say and do what they want in a state where all those things are still criminalized. And though a judge has ruled against them, the legislature and Jindal refused to do anything about the laws.
What was the plus for Bobby Jindal in all of this, other than just joining the media circus or whatever?
The Louisiana electorate?
Yeah. And the rest of the American electorate?
Yeah, but I thought he had sort of like national plans sometimes.
Well, somebody's making a calculation, right, that these things are politically helpful to them in the national races for the primaries? I don't get it.
You got to get through them.
Yeah. What did you make of what happened in Olympia this week? Let me go down the list and ask you about it. Maybe I should say what didn't happen.
Yeah,
It was very like...
It was like the dog that didn't bark in the night.
Nobody bit that dog.
Nobody bit that dog, exactly.
No journalists are down there anymore, right?
What happened to the transportation package?
Well, this has been going on for at least 6, 7, 8 months, because let's flip back a minute here. We were supposed to have a transportation package at the end of the last session. And then, okay, everybody wants to go home. We've been in Olympia too long, so let's let that baby go. And then they were talking supposedly after the summer, maybe a little bit in the summer, we're going to get a transportation package and it's going to please all sides. And we'll probably have a special session on that in November. And then along comes Boeing. Oh, we're really going to have a special session on that in November, followed by didn't happen, didn't work. See you in January.
They take it up in January? Is that the plan?
Well, the plan, I mean, they just can't reach harmony on it. So they always, always forward to the next meeting, right? And hope that something breaks on it.
They're always looking for a last minute deadline. We saw this last year where they kicked it into a special session. And then was it another special session? They're just always looking for the leverage of the last minute.
So their sticking point seems to be, again, around a gas tax and even more so around mass transit.
Right. And so I've heard some of the legislators talk about it, this is really sticky for them. The question of the tax, the gas tax would go up, but what would King County get for the fact that it's going to deliver a lot of the yes votes? And the question is, if it's just going to maintain the current level of transit, how do you sell it? Would you like your taxes to go up? And you will be where you were before you voted for this. It's a tough sell.
I had an interesting conversation with Mike McGinn, my exit interview with the mayor. And we talked about the topic of the transportation package. And one of the things I was curious about is that the House version and the Senate versions are still incredibly loaded toward building new roads and freeways. Very highway focused, very small percentage of the proposed bills. And these are for either maintenance, repair and maintenance, or for transit.
I thought it was also really interesting in your interview that he said he left it open that he might campaign against it.
Well, exactly. So I said, well, you know, given the fact that you have led a campaign that defeated a bill, would you consider leading campaign? And he said, well, that's a good question. Then he kind of smiled and said, I'll leave it there. But I think what he was saying was that
sounds like he's applying.
what he's saying is something that's a problem that even if they come up with a compromise package, it's hard to see that it's going to be transit friendly enough to get a lot of the environmental vote in King County. And if you, like we've seen with other packages, if you do not have if you don't have environmentalists and you lose those people in King County combined with the people who are just going to be knee-jerk against the taxes, that plan's not going to pass. So the legislature has to develop a plan that's going to go, you know.
How critical is this? People. I mean, where we are right now, how critical is the need to get another transportation package?
Well, you have to consider that, and this might not sound good to Mike McGinn, but there are some road projects that don't have enough funding. They're named like 520, 99, you know. Yeah, just there's a bunch of projects that are sort of spinning forward, and yet everybody knows that they're not funded. And then there's also the pressure coming from the transit cuts that are looming. So there's pressure on enough sides for them to actually get together. But they just sort of keep going over the same territory.
Right. Well, then you also have the Boeing issue, which is and I think that's, you know, that brings it back to the kind of critical nature of politically, whether it's a good package or a bad package, of Inslee getting a package. As governor, he's the guy who's going to get blamed if Boeing leaves. He's the guy who is seen, especially because he's a Democrat, of having to deliver labor harmony of some kind. That blew up this week. He infuriated some of the machinists over his desire for a vote on Boeing's latest offer. And he's got to deliver a transportation package, which is part of the list of Boeing's demands. And he hasn't delivered on a couple of key elements of that. And so the transportation package has a whole level of urgency underneath, and they've got to come up with a package that's not going to cause a green rebellion, but will still please a lot of the Republicans and Democrats too, who want more big highways.
Right. We should remember that as you're going to weigh in, that King County Metro is facing huge cuts. Is that what you're going to say?
I was going to talk about King County. I was going to talk about how Inslee pointed out that the Republicans, if they don't manage to come to agreement, are not going to be able to fund the projects that they want in eastern Washington because, as you were alluding to before, what happens is the King County tax base washes around the state and builds or repairs the bridges in, not as much Spokane, but say Yakima or even more remote places, Kettle Falls. And so he's trying to bring the Republicans on board that way. So far, they don't seem to care.
Well, Jay Inslee said also this week that he needed Teddy Roosevelt. He needed somebody he could work with across the aisle. He needed somebody who was, you know, going to be carrying a big stick.
Well, he's recalling the environmental ethics of Teddy Roosevelt and saying, you know, here I am in this state. I am balancing all these interests, and all I want a few Republicans who will behave as if they were the old style Republican, environmentally conscious Teddy Roosevelt, Dan Evans, even Richard Nixon, if you recall, ushered in the Environmental Protection Act. So that is what he's sort of begging for. He is navigating. I'm thinking this is a tough month for Jay Inslee.
Because, reality came home, huh?
Well, you have budgets and all that stuff, but everybody has that. But right now he's sort of got Boeing, and he's got the transportation package. He's in trouble with labor. You know, he's having quite a couple of weeks here.
Well, what about that labor issue? So he told that the machinists that he'd like to see them vote, take a lot of people off. Machinists debated each other, but so far it doesn't look like they're voting, at least not before Christmas, which is what some people were hoping for. Seattle Times was arguing, let them vote. We want to see people vote. And at the same time, Long Beach, which does have lovely beaches, is saying, you know, we also have an educated workforce. We also have people who can do this work, and they're facing even a bigger crisis. So
it's all going to come down to this shorter list, I think it is. I don't know if you call it the short list, but shorter list of communities where the 777X will be built. And I'm sort of two minds on that. I wonder if Washington will be on there.
You wonder.
I wonder. I think, you know, it should be on there. That's for sure. But because the machinists haven't had a chance to vote, is it going to not be on there to kind of show how serious they are about going elsewhere? Very interesting to see the list. And it's going to come out, what, in the next few days or maybe even today?
Well, one of the pieces that Washington has is that, and I think Danny Westneat pointed this out in his column, was that the $8 billion tax package package that the legislature passed to entice Boeing to stay is the largest package for any entity ever passed in American history. It's the biggest giveaway of any. So one of the issues is who can match that. You know, is Missouri going to match that? Is Utah going to match that? Or, you know, now I know that there are more factors than that, but that's one thing that we have on the table. That's whether you agree with it or not, it's a factor. It will be interesting. They have what, 22 states, 54 sites competing. They're gonna see what kind of good deal they can get. And everything has advantages and disadvantages. I mean, Long Beach has this educated workforce, but guess what? They've got unions too. I guess Jerry Brown is, you know, working on some kind of ways of, you know, getting more money for them. But we'll see.
You know, speaking of unions, just on that note, and we were talking about transportation package, Metro Transit drivers rejected their tentative package, their tentative contract agreement last night, which included a three-year pay freeze in the first year, And lawmakers, you know, are still, as you said, negotiating tax package. Metro drivers are facing this proposal, and Metro's facing a 17% cut in services. So I guess that is making it a little bit critical for them to figure out a transportation package. We'll take a break. We'll come back with the news and review on KUOW. You know why I should remember it's Knut Berger? Because Skip came in with a pretty good-looking warm coat. What kind of shoes were you wearing?
Oh, the just North Face, Gore-Tex, you know.
Thought maybe you'd have to walk here, right?
Well, I've had to before.
Yeah, yeah. I know.
When Steve Scherr says the show's going on the night before, no matter what the snow is, you got to get your mailman attitude, mail carrier attitude on.
I thought Eli might sled here this morning, down from Capitol Hill.
If there was more snow.
Yeah.
It's going back up on the sled. It's not so fun.
That was one scary snowstorm, don't you think?
Yeah. Wait, I have to say it wasn't hyped as much as I thought it might be.
You know why? Because the weather forecasters got burned like a week or two ago. They were just absolutely going absolutely bonkers about it a couple weeks ago. And then it was like, oops, sorry, not so much snow. So this time.
Everybody played it down.
Yeah.
And yet we did get some nice dusting, so that was pleasant, and some people got even more. What was top of Capitol Hill?
We had about an inch, maybe an inch and a half, and everyone just seemed to be staying off the roads. So it was a nice, calm walk.
I know people were laughing at me because I rode my bike this morning, but really, nobody was on the main streets, and they were clear, and so I could ride.
The tires and all the slush?
It wasn't icy.
I stopped at the Starbucks in Madison Park, and it's like a ski lodge without skis. I mean, everybody had their ski gear on and the woven, you know, the knit sweaters with the giant snowflakes on them, and everything. They did.
I believe
it. Really, it looked like Aspen, you know, except there's no, you know, there was this half an inch at the most outside, but it was pretty.
Lots of people taking a 3-day weekend out of this.
Or maybe
a 10-day weekend.
Yeah.
Or a 22-day weekend. All right. Well, speaking of the end of the year, which is what the 22-day weekend refers to. All right. So you did an exit interview with McGinn. Ross Reynolds did one with Richard Conlin. And Marcy Silliman did with Norm Rice, who has announced that he's sort of leaving the public sphere for a while. I just want to touch on those three and with a little tape. Here's what Conlin and then Rice had to say. Here's Conlin.
We all came in, I think, with that idea, and we found that there was a lot of wisdom and a lot of experience on the city council, and it actually worked pretty well, that combination. It usually is a good combination to have some people who have been around for a while and some people who are new.
That was Richard Conlin talking about when he first came to the city council all those years ago, and he came with Nick Cotta and this new group of people, brand new, but they were glad that there were some sage older people there to offer them advice. A little bit of perhaps a comment to his rival who won his seat, Shama Sawant. And then Mike McGinn leaving. Norm Rice was talking about his years as city council member and then as mayor, and then later he was Federal Home Loan Bank, and then he was at the Seattle Foundation. But he worked with Mike McGinn on the Families and Education Levy, so Marcy Silliman just back in the early 90s. So Marcy Silliman asked him, you know, what was it like to work with Mike McGinn?
I think that he's one of the most intelligent individuals I've met. But I think it's always to show you that he knows rather than to show you that he hurt.
Well, Mayor Nice sort of refuting that.
Fighting words in Seattle.
Those fighting words.
Roundhouse punch.
All right. And then you gave an exit interview with Mike McGinn. So let's just talk about the changing of the guard here a little bit. I know McGinn's more of a transitional figure, but Rice and Conlin, what are we seeing happening? What's your thoughts?
Well, one of the things that I talked to Mike McGinn about was how he saw politics changing in Seattle. What did he think about? And he talked a bit about the campaign. And he basically was, you know, says that Seattle is sort of been too long ruled by what he calls the donor class. You know, essentially that money is running the city and running, you know, the citywide city council campaigns, they all, you know, the mayor, you all have to go and, as he put it, you know, you have to kiss the right rings and get your money from the same sources to run the campaigns. And so it drives out diversity of opinion. It drives out diversity on the council. He sees districts as a really good thing because it's going to increase – it will diversify the donor base is essentially his argument, that people will have different constituencies, that it will significantly change where the money goes because people will have to horse trade. If the downtown waterfront wants funding for its renewal, it's going to have to – get something for West Seattle. It's going to have to get something for District 2, District 5. So he thinks that the landscape has already changed significantly. And he had one great comment. He said, when I came into office, or, he says, right now you have 9 city council people worried about keeping their jobs. When I came into office 4 years ago, you had 4 or 5 city council people who wanted my job. And
as it has always been.
And he's saying that the change in politics by district and by Conlon's defeat is already underway, that people are kind of already beginning to figure out or try to figure out what this new political reality would be.
Hmm. Sounds to me like Mike McGinn is going out much the way he came in, sort of with that street fighter tone that he brings to certain things. I do think that the city is changing dramatically, not just by the presence of a mayoral change, which is big enough, but the district elections will have a bigger impact than many of us have imagined, because it puts everybody sort of in a different orientation to how they're thinking about the city, unless you're one of the 2 at-large members. One thought about Norm Rice and sort of how he was toward Mike McGinn. If you remember early on, Norm Rice and Charlie Royer went and met with the new mayor. It was pretty early in the term. And they both gave him, you know, tons of advice, much of which he didn't exactly listen to. But I remember a piece of advice that Charlie Royer wanted Mike McGinn to have. And it was this notion that, you know, Mike McGinn is a litigator, so usually in litigation somebody wins and somebody loses. But that in politics, different, and this was his piece of advice, that definitely somebody wins and somebody loses, but the skilled politician will make sure that both sides feel they got something and they both feel like winners.
Well, that's interesting, because Patty Murray, in her argument about the budget compromise, made the argument that seems to be the prevalent argument today, which isn't that one. It's the argument, well, we all feel crappy about it, so I guess it's a good deal.
That's the other way of making everyone feel like winners.
Yeah, I guess so.
If they're all in it together.
Yeah, we're all in it together.
You know, going back to Conlon just for a sec, McGinn said that he thought that, you know, he talked about working with Richard Conlon, and they had big disagreements on the tunnel and on 520. He had respect for each other. And he said that he didn't think Conlon's defeat was really about Conlon. He felt it was that Shama Sawant could have beaten any of the older incumbents in that situation in this election. He felt the dynamics of people being tired with the status quo, with kind of an aging city council, was enough. And it just happened that it was Richard's year to be up, and so he got the target on his back. If it had been Sally Bagshaw or Tim Burgess or somebody else, that target would have been drawn on their back as well. And so he thinks that's part of a shifting dynamic within the city that has not fully played out. It's new.
And about urgency, we talked about this last week, and McGinn has just given some great exit interviews. It's very illuminating to hear, and it's also, I agree, we're hearing the real McGinn, who had trouble as mayor, and maybe is showing himself at least where he belongs next, back in the activist world, where he can do what he wants, which is push forward, push the envelope, push the edge of the bubble of what Seattle is comfortable with, rather than seek the middle, which is what he has been complaining about.
Which is why perhaps he gave you the answer that he did, Skip, about maybe he'll be the guy working on the anti-transportation platform there.
I think the one thing he seemed a little chastened about was I asked him, I said, well, you know, when Shama Sawant got into the race, she kind of made comments of like, well, I'm not really, you know, I don't have to win. I just need to have a good showing. I mean, I there's a moral victory if I get, you know, 40% or something like that. And it turned out, of course, the dynamics were such that she won. And I said, when you ran for mayor in 2009, when you announced, did you really think you were going to win? He said, absolutely. I knew the day I made my decision, I knew I was going to win. He says, you know, do you play hearts? And I said, yeah, sometimes. And he said, well, you know what shooting the moon is, you know, when you go for all the hearts. And he said, I knew, I looked at my hand, my political hand, and I knew I could shoot the moon in 2009. And I did, and it paid off. And then he said, unfortunately, you know, well, he didn't say unfortunately, but he basically said, I think I tried to shoot the moon too often in the job.
That's very interesting.
He overplayed his hand, he said, too many times.
I just point out, he's told the opposite story about his candidacy. At
least. Is that right?
Oh, well, that's interesting.
I think to seem more humble, you know, I didn't think I was going to get in. I just believed in some things. And so we thought we had a chance and there we were.
Is that a more recent story? I mean, is that also a recent
story?
We'd have
to go back and listen. I've heard it, and we'd have to go back and listen, but I think he actually told that story to Marcy Silman in his exit.
That'd be funny.
Well, you know, a week can change a lot of perspective.
But you get reflective and you sort of think both things.
Or you get tired of telling the story that you don't want to tell, and you start telling the real story.
Let's try this story.
According to you.
Well, I just wanted to add here that Shama may have beaten anybody, everybody, all of that. But there will be a mainstreaming for her that will come. And Ed Murray this week, if I may interject this, seemed to be signaling that, you know, he's the man who likes to create committees. The four of us are the only ones that haven't been on any of those committees so far, but there's always tomorrow. But anyway, so his $15 an hour minimum wage committee, talk about mainstreaming, has. If you look through the list, you get all the way down to the bottom. What's the last name? Shama Sawant on the committee. So she is now going to be pulled into more of the mainstream. She's probably there not to be the mainstream voice or anything like that, but she's on that committee. She has ownership of whatever they put out.
It instantly makes it the most interesting of all of Ed Murray's 27 committees.
She is smart enough to know that she has to make an effort at doing it the Seattle way before she pulls out whatever card she needs to pull out to do it another way if it doesn't move fast enough. She's the spark plug for this thing. And, you know, she said this week she had a press conference before Murray's press conference. And she was very vague on the specifics, and I think it was anticipating that she was going to be part of a process, and she didn't want to cut her options off. And she, you know, what she is saying is timeliness is really important. Getting this done, not having this be something that kicks in 3 years or 4 years, but something that kicks in 2014. And she has the. She also has the thing of if it doesn't, we'll do a referendum. I mean, we'll go to the voters, and she will win that.
She did seem to be driving the timeline for Mr. Murray because she had said if we don't get somewhere by April, then she'll look at the other methods, including the initiative, which is, you know, a blunter instrument and all of that. And so then Murray says, yeah, we want to do this in 4 months. So it seemed like that was driving that particular bus right there.
Well, she was, I thought, being very careful, too, to say, I get that small business has special issues. I'm for the working class, so, you know, I'm looking out for the workers, but I'm also going to look out for small businesses. She was making comments that clearly sort of said, there's room for discussion. I'm not expecting the law to one day be $9 an hour and the next day be 15. But she wants it on a greased schedule.
And here you see the value of an activist politician who pulls everyone else who would prefer to study and convene committees and really think about it, pulls them along more quickly, imposes a faster timeline than maybe everyone would like.
Yeah, but I mentioned this last week. If you pull that council, and I have not done this, but I feel like I already know the answer, which I bet you the vote on some version of a minimum wage will be 9-0. It's so easy to tell. I don't know of a single council member that's leading the charge against.
Well, one Jay thing, Inslee took it up as well.
But one thing that often happens when you have activists, and Shama is one from Occupy and whatnot, is that they often will participate in these things for show so that you can fail and they can twist it on you. So the question will be how genuine is she in terms of working stuff out? It sounds like she's genuine, but
you mean within the committee?
Within the committee, yeah. But it's also possible to say, you're blocking me, I'm going to go to the people. And So she's kind of in a no-lose situation in terms of that, in terms of the politics of that part of it.
Let me ask you a question to end this segment because I'm curious. So Norm Rice, Richard Conlon, you mentioned Charlie Royer. I don't know if he fits into this thesis. You said the Seattle process earlier. And now we had McGinn. That's why I say maybe a transition figure. I don't know. Murray, you say, is maybe back to Seattle process. Are we seeing not just a shift in the structure of the political situation, but are we seeing a different kind of person historically running for office, serving, or not? I mean, can we look back to a more activist grassroots council 30 years ago, 50 years ago, mayors 30, 50 years ago?
Well, we've had it sort of ebbs and flows. Remember, Czech came in the late 60s. They were like, was it in groups of two and then four change agents that came in. And then you'll have like a period where it's a little bit quieter and maybe one or two sloughs off. And now we're back to sort of bigger change here. But just in the, you know, I mean, just one council member is being replaced.
Maybe I'm asking if it's more radical change. Well, radical politics, more radical in the left wing.
I think that depends on the economy. But I think things are aligning to make that possible. And which is, if you go back to the politics of the 1930s and the 1940s, where you had labor and reform groups and the business community going at it, hammer and tong. And you had pro-labor mayors and pro-business mayors and kind of, you know, switching off, and the pro-labor mayors having to appease the business community and the pro-business mayors having to appease labor. And I mean, if you go back to the teens, 20s, 30s, and 40s, we are way more civil and way more polite. We don't have anything like the kind of labor activism and whatnot. But the dynamics of our economy are set up that a lot of people in the middle class or formerly in the middle class, as well as people in the working class, are being increasingly edged out as many people in the city become increasingly affluent. And, you know, we're seeing in San Francisco where citizens are doing sit-ins in front of Google's bus because they don't want a two-tier bus system. So you're seeing the most liberal city in America next to Seattle.
All right. I want to touch on that again later in the later. You know, if you've been thinking about some of these issues, shoot us an email. I'd like to read some of them. Week in Review at KUOW.org. I'd like to hear what you're thinking about some of these issues today. I want to shift to a couple other stories, though, that I thought were interesting. On a serious note, new use of force policy for SPD going into effect. And I wonder what you made of that use of force decision. We haven't really seen – we've only kind of got inklings of it from folks. But is this the reform people were thinking they were going to receive?
Well, certainly change has been essential for the police department. By now, no one is arguing that change is coming and needs to come and all of that good stuff. I thought one of the most interesting parts of it, which played down pretty far down in the story, is that officers will now be armed with one less than lethal tool. So this gets into pepper spray. And I couldn't help but think about the John T. Williams case. And there's other cases where pepper spray, instead of everything else, would have been, you know, and it had a different outcome. And it just so I think that's probably a positive there. We'll see how it plays out. You don't want to go around pepper spraying everybody, of course, but pepper spray as an extra tool or some other non-lethal item could really change the way the police interact with the citizens.
There's also going to be a lot more record keeping. If you simply draw your gun on someone, that is considered use of force to the degree that you would have to make a record of it afterward. And so that, I think, is going to be a big change for the Seattle police, and it will create a really different level of accountability than there was before. It will also create a lot more work, and I'm sure we will hear from the police union, if not some of the police themselves, that it's too much work. I think there also may be a question of how you actually enforce this unless it was caught on camera. How do you know that whether or not the officer did some of these lower level actions, like just say unholstering his gun. If it's just a he said, someone else said.
That's what I was wondering. It could be a lot more work. Do you think that?
So are those cameras on the police officers?
The button cameras?
Yeah. We had a burglary in our neighborhood, and so that we had to call the police for a neighbor. And I noticed when the officers showed up that they had this light, this little green light flashing, that they were recording pretty much their entire interaction with those of us in the neighborhood who were describing what was going on.
I didn't see any reaction from the Police Officers Guild at this point about that use of force plan. I know they're kind of waiting. Have any of you seen anything or heard anything?
No. On a lot of these things, it feels like everyone's taking a long weekend.
Yeah.
Come back in the new year and talk about it.
Yeah. And, of course, the other story that arose out of that was what prospects this use of force and the moving forward on the consent decree holds for Jim Pugel, who does seem to want the job. There was some evidence that he'd have to resign to be considered for this job.
Right, because there was some sense that if there is an acting or interim or however you want to phrase it, that is off-putting to candidates. And you've heard people say, many people, Ed Murray, some of the members of the committee, everybody wants the biggest possible pool of potential finalists, and they're looking for something that's kind of tricky in these situations. You know, people who are already in police departments, they don't like their names out because then their city and city council and mayor find out that they have ye old wandering eye, you know, that kind of thing. And so it is a tricky little, dilemma. But so what would they do? Put an interim? I mean, that's unwieldy on this end. As well. So, you know, maybe it's in the way that the search committee or search company explains it to the other folks that I don't know how to phrase that exactly right, because Jim Pugel does want to be a finalist.
Yeah, it looks like they have to go out of their way to convince potential applicants that there's not a guy who's got the job wired, that the inside guy. So it seems very awkward to ask, you know, Pugel to resign and then reapply for his job. But that seems to be what they're considering.
And what other job does he end up with once he's resigned if he doesn't get the chief's job in the overall hiring process? I mean, he really, really wants it. I think he's also painted himself into a very hard corner here. And I think what he's hearing over and over
again. Wait, why has he painted himself into a corner?
Because he has to resign if he wants the job. If he stays in the job that is the job he wants, he can't have the job he ultimately wants because it's got to go to someone else. I mean, we were talking about a win-win situation for Shama Sawant on that council committee a minute ago. This is lose-lose for Pugel as far as I see it. And maybe I'm reading too much between the lines, but from what I read, he is being told over and over again that he is not going to get this job. I don't know that he hears that yet.
I don't know that he's been told that. I think he's been told there will be a nationwide search and there will be no preference toward him. And there will always be a job. They'll put him back to captain or something like that. You know, he's very well regarded. And also, don't forget, just a week or two ago, we were talking about how he made these seemingly at the time dramatic changes in some of the command staff that really upset some folks. But to me, that looked like he was showing, I can run this department, I can make the tough personnel decisions, and yes, I can deal with senior command, which people have been upset with, some of them, too.
And there's no doubt, even among the people who are telling Pugel to slow down or think differently about this, that he is qualified, that he is one of the SPD's stars. It's just that it doesn't seem that things are lining up in a way that will work for him to become the chief. There's a very strong desire for someone from the outside in this job, and you can understand why. And I'm not sure that you can convince the public and the council, which is the first thing you need to do if you're ever going to convince Murray, that someone from the inside can change the culture of the SPD.
You know, the other thing about this use of force document, it's pretty easy to read. It's pretty clear, straightforward. And the last thing in it is a strong partnership between the department and the community is essential for effective law enforcement and public policy. The fact that they have to restate that reminds us of where we are. People are going to be watching not this announcement, right? They're going to be seeing if all these different ideas are actually implemented, and that's going to take a little while.
Yes.
All right. Just thought I'd make my editorial comment there. I want to ask you about if you're doing your part to gin up the revenues for marijuana, because Governor Inslee said that there may not be. Don't count on all the revenue is what he was saying to some of the cities and the counties. And at the same time, you're not going to be smoking in bars, so just stay at home. But turns out that people maybe are smoking a lot more pot in the state than initially thought. And, of course, they've done some other studies that sort of bring it up. So what was it, 175 metric tons?
I think that was the
median.
That was the median, but you know the state officials who were working on this were working.
Wait, that was the median per pot smoker?
No.
Yes,
total state. But they,
I know people like that. Yeah.
They were working with a figure of 165 metric tons, and this is one delicate balancing act here, because they are ramping up for recreational pot. It has to compete with the black market. It can't go too quickly. And also there's the medical marijuana situation here in this state. And it is really tricky.
Here's what I find to be the most interesting finding in that RAND study that the state is now using to inform itself about how much marijuana to produce. So, right, 175 metric tons per our state per year is the current estimate. And there are roughly 750,000 marijuana users in the state, which is interesting just to put that in perspective of a state with a population of 6.6 million. So that adds some perspective there. But here's the most interesting finding. The vast majority of that 175 metric tons is consumed, smoked, by a very small core of that 750,000 people.
Most of the guys on the app.
I don't know. There are a very small number of people in Washington State who are smoking a tremendous amount of pot. It's pretty amazing if the RAND study is right.
Surprise, surprise.
Joni Balter, Knute Berger, Eli Sanders talking about Week in Review and talking about the state's marijuana policies. Luke Burbank is the host of the podcast TBTL, also the host of Livewire that is on Friday nights on KUOW. He's in Leavenworth. Luke, are you going to be doing your bit to help the state, sell that pot, get some revenues?
I'll tell you what, Leavenworth is not immune from that very small group of people who are doing most of the enjoyment of the marijuana. We were at this place last night, my wife and I, and we should have known because there was a jam band playing. But the bar, what would happen is people would go outside. They would smoke some weed, and then they would come back in. But so much of it would be, like, radiating from their dreadlocks and layers of clothing. The entire bar, it smelled like a Cheech and Chong movie. So much weed being smoked in Leavenworth last night. So
how many metric tons?
Some of the people that you're talking about.
But and
say
yet,
hi for me.
Yeah, and yet, of course, that's not going to be – well, because I guess they can go outside and hide, but that's not supposed to be legal anymore. So where are they all going to – what are they all going to do?
I mean, I reported them.
Oh, yes. Indeed, you did.
Not okay. I'm glad to see, by the way, that you guys are enjoying some snow in Seattle, because my wife and I decamped from Seattle yesterday to go to Christmas City, USA, and enjoy the snow. I'm looking at a completely bare and dry Best Western parking lot here.
Really?
You better drive fast if you want to see the snow here, because it's melting.
That's
well,
something.
At least this morning in the Seattle Times, my neighbor looked like a Courier and Ives situation.
Yeah, but you have to snap that picture within 3 hours or it melts.
I actually heard that people had horses and with bells on in your neighborhood. So that was very nice.
So it's incredibly idyllic and wintry, and we've managed to go to where they're smoking weed and there's no snow.
Welcome to Washington State. Say, what do you all make of, and Luke, you get to start, 49ers fans raising money for San Francisco, bragging billboard, as the PI headline put it, in Seattle. So they're raising money to put up how many Super Bowl trophies do you have, Seattle?
And I believe it's going to have a photograph of their 5 Super Bowl trophies.
Yeah, correct. Right there, those beautiful silver.
Yeah, but it's only one billboard. Where are they going to put this thing so that the most number of people can see it?
They only had to raise $7,000. They've already say they've got $8,000.
So they're on their way to their second billboard.
I have to say, this is really sad for San Francisco because, I used to live in San Francisco. I love San Francisco. They used to not care about whatever Seattle did. And they have fallen so low that they have to, get back at us. It just shows, I think, something's changed psychologically.
I think they're freaked out that we got the Innovation Award this week. And so that's starting to get pretty deep under the skin.
You're talking about all the money that they're tossing around. You're talking about all the money that they're tossing around in San Francisco. Here's just another example of it. They've got so much, they're putting up billboards up here.
Yeah, well, what's the next billboard going to be? Hey, it rains up there, you guys.
Well, Luke, what were you saying?
Well, first of all, it's retaliation because we flew a banner over their stadium before the game.
Oh, that's right.
That's right.
Yeah, but we're the hick town.
But the thing I will give them credit on is that they have raised extra money and they're donating that money to Seattle Children's. So it's... as long as the money, or at least the extra money, is going to a worthy cause, I don't really have a problem with it. I'm kind of into rivalries, though. I know it's very un-Seattle, but when I was
that's old Seattle. It is part of Seattle now. I think that's what I'm concluding. Rivalries are good, Luke. We should go for it.
I like that. What I mean is, it's not in the. I don't think it's the Northwesterner's nature is to hold sports-related grudges, but I like that we're starting to do that and kind of go back and forth. I remember when I was a kid and the Seahawks were in the AFC. I just hated John Elway so much, and I remember I had one of those Bronco Busters T-shirts. It was like a Ghostbuster sign, but with the Broncos logo in it. So the idea that we're sort of going back and forth with San Francisco and there's this bad blood that's forming, I think it's great. I think it makes me feel like we're living in a real sports town.
Yeah. Hey, what'd you make of Nirvana getting into the Hall of Fame? The Rock and Roll Hall of Fame.
Enthusiasm for that, by the way.
Well, who can we be really okay? San Francisco. I remember hating the Broncos too, but now Colorado and Washington State. I mean, we're joined at the hip in our marijuana distribution.
We're pot brothers. Pot brothers.
So who are we gonna get mad at? Vancouver.
I wouldn't mess with them. Rumor that Canadians are sort of America Junior and that they're docile, but that has not been my experience at all.
Yeah, what happens when we get an NHL team?
You could say, well, you haven't had a Stanley Cup in 100 years, eh?
Yeah.
Is that what the billboard says?
By the way, was that your Canadian?
Yeah.
Oh, you're going to need to work on it.
Was that Von Palmer?
Yeah, that was Von Palmer. Right?
I thought it was pretty good.
It was Von Berger. Berger.
What do you make? You get the last word on Nirvana. What do you make of Nirvana going in the Hall of Fame? I am excited.
Well,
by
I mean, I think they were a pretty amazing musical act. I think it's probably. I mean, it is not good how Kurt Cobain passed away, but I think it's. I'm glad I don't get to see a 60-year-old Kurt Cobain playing halftime of the Super Bowl.
Mm-hmm.
So they're sort of encased in amber of your youth and awesomeness. So I salute them.
I think I saw Iggy Pop doing something similar to that. You get the last word on it, I guess.
I think what he wrote in his diary was, it's better to burn out than to fade away. Same sentiment.
All right, LiveWire tonight at 8 o'clock. We will be listening to you.
It's going to be fun.
You got Tobolowsky telling stories tonight?
We've got Tobo. It'll be worth listening to.
Tobo. I hope you use that with him, too.
I did. I asked him on stage if I'm allowed to call him Tobo, and I think he said no.
Yeah.
But I'm still doing it.
Luke Burbank is host of LiveWire tonight at 8 on KUOW, also host of the podcast TBTL, Too Beautiful to Live. Joni Balter is a news analyst. Merry Christmas.
And to you, too.
And Luke, Merry Christmas. Eli Sanders at The Stranger, Merry Christmas.
Thank you. Same to you.
Thank you.
And yes, Luke, you are welcome. Phones are so weird. Knut Berger, Merry Christmas.
Merry Christmas.
And I think what will be in your stocking is the Knut Burger.
Yum.
Dripping.
Yum. Hey, I had to eat lutefisk as a kid, so.
Oh, my.
I think I can deal with that.
Jason Pagano produces this show. Bernard Ouellette is our engineer. Ann Kane is helping us out. We will talk to you on the record and again next week. I'm Steve Scherr.